Hi, I'm an alcoholic and my name is Tony T. Reggie, what do we have, about 2 minutes to go? All right. I just want to thank the committee, and especially Linda and Frank, for the gracious courtesy that they've shown both my wife and me this weekend. And it's just special. Thank you. You're great people. I said I am an alcoholic, and my home group is the Mayflower Group, which meets on Monday nights in West Hartford at 8 o'clock. I just asked for sobriety, and I've gotten several boots in the butt when I needed it from those folks, and you all know what a home group means. And if you don't know, ask somebody, and we'll tell you. I came from a half-alcoholic and half-diabetic household. My father was a diabetic, never tasted alcohol, but saw the effects of it. My mother, on the other hand, tasted alcohol, knew what it was all about, and knew how it could change personalities when needed. So I grew up in an environment, and I will not call it dysfunctional because that word wasn't available, I don't think, when I was growing up. At least I hadn't read it in the dictionary yet. But it was a different household. While a lot of the other kids were going out and playing baseball and Little League and all that other good stuff, I was home trying to do washing, a little bit of ironing. Never learned how to cook. My wife will attest to that. But I just tried to do it to try and keep peace in that family because I didn't like what happened when he came home and things were not done. So, you know, I made a promise to myself that as soon as I could, I would get out of that household and go do whatever. I adopted the people next door to me as sort of surrogate parents because he'd come home at night, she'd meet him at the door, and honest to God, it was like the Cleavers. They'd hug, you know, and I didn't see that. So I kind of migrated over there because I liked it. I liked the feeling. I did turn 18. I could enlist in the Army, and I did. And as I left the railroad station down here in Hartford, my mom made the effort to come and see me off, and she proceeded to become sick at the platform, and kind of that was the last sight that I saw when I left. And I promised the God of my understanding that day that if I was ever fortunate to have children, that they would not see what I saw and have to do what I did. Obviously something went wrong because I'm standing before you tonight. And I spent the next 3 years getting an education in first generation of computers, but and I'm not going to go through my entire service career because nothing major happened except like I said, I left the Hartford Railroad Station. We went to New Haven, and a bunch of college grads got on the train, and we were all going to Fort Dix, New Jersey, in Trenton. And these guys were 21, 22, and they knew how to drink. And I had sampled it. I had stolen a little bit from my mom because she'd never know how much was missing anyway. Long story short, we got to Trenton. Tony T got off the train, fell flat on the platform, and passed out, drunk, because I wanted to be like these guys. So I went in the Army on my back. Not a nice way to go. You automatically volunteer for things that you don't want to do, so on and so forth. There was a master plan here, too. My bride-to-be went to nursing school. I was going in the Army. We were going to get all this good stuff out of the way and then get married when I got out. Volunteered for Germany, and they sent me to Alaska. I was up there when Alaska became a state, I think. Don't remember too much of that little tour, except it didn't get dark a lot, and you could drink a lot, and I was up there in prime time. It was great weather. And then I was asked to come back to New York City and be stationed at Governor's Island because my mom had really hit the weeds. the skids in Hartford, front row, front street in Hartford, and I would go find her and take her to AA. So at a young age, I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't really catch on too much to what it was all about, but at least tried to get a safe environment for my mom. I'm not sharing my mother's story, I'm sharing my own. After quite a few years of more abuse, my mother did find this program. And even though she was institutionalized, we had 12 years of her sobriety and a few years of my sobriety to celebrate together. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm very grateful. The bride was there. The bride-to-be was waiting. September 22nd, when I was 21, it was my 21st birthday. I left New York City. I could drink in Connecticut legally. I got off the train and wound up in the same position that I entered the Army in, prone, right at the feet of my bride-to-be. She thought it was just celebration because I was 21 getting out of the Army, and so did I. We did get married the following year, and we had another master plan. We would get a little home in the suburbs and then save up a few bucks, get established in our jobs, and then have a family. 13 months later, after we got married, my first son decided he was going to blow the master plan, and he came into this world. And I was very, very grateful for that, because he was a boy, and I could see the Little League games, I saw soccer games coming, all the things that I couldn't do as a boy growing up. And alcohol around the house was, while it was a common word, we were both doing pretty well. I was still able to hold my share, and she was a wonderful, wonderful drinking partner. She didn't change personalities. I started to. Second son was born a couple of years later. And again, the same feelings. Two boys, more sports, things for me to get involved in. Well, that first Little League game did happen. The Little League game did happen, and it came to Newington, where I was living at the time. And when the game started, I was asked to leave. I wasn't a coach. I wasn't an umpire. I was a parent, a spectator in the bleachers, doing things, saying things that weren't kind of apropos for a Little League game in a suburban town. So I was asked to leave that field, and here I was that few short years later, that promise I made to the God of my understanding. I was embarrassing my kids and my bride, and here I go. Here goes another merry-go-round. The warning started gently at first, and then they got a little stronger from my wife, and then her parents, like, could you slow down your drinking? We don't like it when you're drinking gin martinis. It just changes you. I could buy that, so I went to vodka. And I was learning how to do what a lot of us know how to do best, and that was change the focus. When the pressure started coming in on me because of what I was doing in the home, I would turn it around, pick on something that she or the kids were doing, and that was my license to get in the car, get out, and go get drunk. And this was the road that kept on for quite a few years. I guess it was 1966 that I was having some severe stomach problems. No one knew why. Well, I didn't know why. I think a lot of other people did. And I was put into Hartford Hospital. And I always remember this. I went in on the 10th floor in a private room, and my uncle was on the 11th floor. He had a lung removed for cancer, and I was in for whatever my stomach problems were. And every evening, or a couple of the evenings, around 5 o'clock, my wife would leave my room, go up to his room, they'd close the door with my aunt, and he was able to have a medicinal sip. And so they'd be drinking a cocktail or two in his hospital room, and I still don't understand this, and I'm downstairs drinking this white chalky crap because I'm going to go have a test. Resentment number one. And it was also the first time that somebody told me I had to stop drinking. Because of my health. I got out of the hospital 9 days later after some stomach surgery, And the doctor diagnosed me as being a very hypertensive person. And he had to give me something for this hypertension. And it wasn't blood pressure pills, it was Valium. And on the bottle of Valium it said, take 3 or 4 times a day or as needed. I saw those 3 words. That's all I had to... And it became my crutch. It was my enabler. It helped me get up in the morning and go to work and be able to write a little bit without shaking too much. Get me through till 12 o'clock or earlier, when where I worked, there was a cocktail lounge right across the street. And over I'd go and join people for lunch, have a few drinks, and eat. And this is important. You got to remember that. I was still eating. And I'd go back to work, come home, do the nightly martinis, whatever. I broke every rule in the medical book that I told what I was told not to do. The fun had gone out of it. I believe that this is when I crossed the invisible line that we don't see. No more fun. No more fun at parties. Memory loss. Constant reminders at home about what I had done or not done the night before. Embarrassment to the kids. And the warnings. The warnings were getting serious. And by now we had had we had built our own home in Newington. I was proud of it for a little while. And I came home one night from New York from a business trip. And the train stops in Berlin, and right there in Berlin is a bar. And I went in that bar, had a couple, got in the car, came home, and drove up this L-shaped driveway, made it into the garage without hitting it for a change. And there's the bride standing at the door with a martini in her hand, and she's offering me the drink. And being the good alcoholic that I was getting to be, of course I took it. I thanked her, and she said, am I going to be home that night? And I said, yes. And she said, that's good, we're having company. Okay, if you have pencils and papers, I want you to write this one down now. I went and got the crystal martini shaker, made martinis, wet the outside of it, put it in the refrigerator, in the freezer. These were going to be just right. Took the glasses, dunked them in water, put them in the freezer, and I'm waiting for the company. Of course, I'm having one while I'm waiting. All of a sudden, I heard this car coming down the street, and it was like, you know how what happens when your muffler is like not on your car? It's a little noisy, a little bit of smoke, and it was like a tan, beat up. A lot of you aren't going to know this one, Studebaker. There are some older people in this crowd, and up the driveway it came, and this little short man got out with a beat up, kind of wrinkly, dirty raincoat. And I thought it was Columbo. Honest to God. Here he comes. And he's got this paper in his hands, and I'm looking at him and not suspecting anything. And he came to the door, and he said he was Sheriff so-and-so, and am I Mr. T? And I said, yes. He said, this is good. Your wife is suing you for divorce. Here's the papers. And we recommend that you leave the house tonight. I don't know what I did. That first moment when I got the feelings, but all of a sudden the thought process led me down the road like, this might not be a bad thing. I could get out of this house. I do not have to listen to the bickering. I don't have to listen to my kids that I had stolen their paper money. But I could get out, get a bachelor pad, date all the gorgeous women in the city of Hartford, and drink to my heart's content. Bye-bye. Martini pitcher, it's going with me. The glasses are going with me. Where I screwed up was I took the old car. Should I have my water? I should have taken the new car. Thank you. I just got thirsty when I was talking about the martini pitcher. But I had those important items in a brown paper bag, of course. And I don't know what the heck else I took. I jumped in the car and off I went. Now, I said I lived in Newington. Newington is bordered by the Berlin Turnpike. A lot of palatial bachelor pads on the Berlin Turnpike. So I went on this tour, with my 1956 Mustang, a little bit of cardboard on the floor side of the driver's side. And I'm going down, and all of a sudden, over here on the other side, I saw this bright red lights, and it said Siesta Motel. Whoa, we're going to turn around, and we're going in. They had the audacity to tell me that they were full. Where am I going to go now? My car's pointing the other way, like it's going to be south of the Berlin Turnpike. And I kept going, and all of a sudden I saw Bolarama, Maple Motel, Cheers Package Store. What more do you want? I pulled in. This lovely, and she was a lovely Lithuanian woman that owned this motel. I don't think she wanted to take me in, but she did. And so in I go, palatial bachelor pad. It had three important features to it. I closed the door, and it had a major bolt lock. And I slammed that bolt lock shut, and you couldn't get in. It had a big Venetian blind that dropped down over a picture window. I could drop that blind, you couldn't see in. And it had a refrigerator for my friend, the martini pitcher and the glasses. It had a stove, I don't know why, pots and pans. And for the next couple of years, that was my house. That was my prison. It was my medical ward. A lot went on in that room that I don't remember. And God has seen fit, at least to this day, not to give me back too many of those memories or bring those to light. Something weird happened that night, too. All the gorgeous women in the city of Hartford took off for Boston. They're not there. Bachelor pad we got. Drink to my heart's content, I can. A short time after, I got the information that I had endangered both my boys' lives in a car, and my visitation rights were pulled. I got them back once, and I had the boys come up to the motel, and my youngest didn't like what he saw because he saw drinking, kind of a sloshed, mocus dad. And he took off out through the back of the motel. And that motel borders where the Newington Crippled Children's Home used to be. And it's a sharp drop. And I couldn't find him, nor could my older son. And the worst thoughts came through to me. Not too long after, the phone rang, and it was the bride, thankfully telling me that he had gotten home. I don't know how he did it, but he had walked home from there. So that was, I guess, the final straw. And the divorce became final. And the divorce decree read something like, you know, it's going to be 50-50. I got the outside, she got the inside. Told you I should have taken the new car. I'm grateful. I am very, very grateful to this day that I didn't get anything from that marriage. But what my wife had done at the time, my ex-wife, had taken what would have been my share, invested it after she sold the home for both my boys' education. And they got it. Both my boys received an education, and that money was there. I would have squandered it, as you know, and it wouldn't have lasted long, and then there wouldn't have been nothing. So I'm very grateful to her. And through the steps of this program, especially when I got to 8 and 9, I've been able to tell her that, exactly that, and make those amends. So I went on for the next couple of years, getting up in the morning, going to work. I don't know how I survived, but work was there. And then it got to the point where I worked in a big tower building that looks down over a roadway that goes across the street to the cocktail lounge. And it got to be a daily routine. Every morning I'd go out the front door of that company, could care less. I had to get to the back door of that motel as soon as I could. Valium wasn't happening, and it wasn't being prescribed for me anymore. I'd go around the back door, and Gabe the bartender, would have that door open. I'd go down the stairs, my beautiful enabler. That's what he was. And there was a water tumbler on that bar with a straw, and it had vodka in it. And I'd drink it through the straw, make it from here to the doorway, and maybe get sick along the way, go to the John, get sick. This is a wonderful way to drink. It really is. But then something would happen. I would stop being sick, and that warmth, it would go down, and it would start in the pit of my stomach and come back up, and now I was okay. The jitter stopped. My tongue started working fairly well. And I'd go through lunch, only now I wasn't eating. I'd meet the guys over there and then go back to the motel, continue on until I passed out. 38-year-old man, winding up with rubber sheets underneath the real sheets. Couldn't understand why. Of course, you're wet in the bed. Went on a final business trip. And I thought it was a four-day trip. It was really a day and a half or 2 days up in Boston. And I had gotten a huge car because we were taking five other people. I was giving a presentation before the industry, insurance industry. Got up there, and this is all hearsay, gave the presentation, embarrassed everyone that was with me, tried to sell the company car. Fortunately, I did not have the keys, could not put through the transaction. I guess I needed money. And woke up that Friday morning in the motel. And there's the trusty old Mustang out in front with a few more bangs in the front. And back then, we were wearing leisure suits to work. And this was a powder blue leisure suit. Okay? With white shoes. Oh, yeah. Just remember, bell bottoms are back. Powder blue's coming back, too. But I remember these red spots down the front of it, and that didn't come when I bought it. There was blood on it, and I don't know how that came to be. I have since found out. I was back up in the Boston area on a business trip, and I went into, I forgot the hotel now. But it had very shiny oak stairs with a brass railing going downstairs, the Parker House. And the fellow I was with said, "You remember this place?" And I said, "No." He said, "You did a header quite a few years ago, and I was here when you did it, and it's so nice to see you can walk the stairs." And I was grateful. That was a little thing. That's where the blood did come from. Anyway, I went into work that Friday. I made it in. I was a little late. And two young girls, one of them was just turned 21, took me into a conference room and let me have it between the eyes. How everything that priests, my in-laws, my ex-wife, my kids, what everybody had been telling me for years, she was repeating it. Only the way she said it, it got to me. I don't know why, but I broke down, I started crying, and I picked up the phone and I called our employee assistance person. And I'm going to be forever grateful for the committees in Alcoholics Anonymous when they come up with literature for the professional community. That helped assure that the employee assistance program was there for this drunk. And I reached out for help, and he said, "Can you come over here around 1 o'clock this afternoon?" I'm looking at my watch. It's 11. Oh, yeah, I can go get fortified first. And I went across the street. And I couldn't get drunk. And I couldn't get sober. It was just this mocha state. And I made that. I made that appointment. I got in his office, and he had a folder. And I thought this man was so anal. He had my name that was typed up there already. You know, I called him at 11. It's now 1 o'clock. But then next to it said 1975. This was 1978. I had been over there before and didn't remember it. But the documentation in that file said that I had said my management didn't understand me, no one understood me, I was going through a divorce, and they let me stay, cunning, baffling, and powerful, once again. And he said, "We're going to give you one shot. We're going to send you to a drunk farm." That caught me. That got my attention. Drunk farm, I figured animals. I pictured all kinds of animals. Four-legged, not two. And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Well, we're going off to Witch Hazel Monday morning. Can you make it?" I said, "Witch Hazel?" He said, "Hi, Hazel." He said, "Hi, something." And I said, "Okay, I'll meet you." And he said, "No, I'll come get you Monday." So I went home, home. I went to the motel, the big pack, picked up the telephone, and I called all of you. What a great guy I am. I'm going away. I'm going to get help. And I still have some phone bills from those calls. And drank everything in sight. You know, you can hide stuff in a one-room motel room just like you can in a nine-room house. And I scurried, and I scurried. And finally, Monday morning came, and off we went. And I pulled up in his car in front of a place that had a red barn. And it had a coffee cup hanging off the front of the barn. It's a hell of a place to put a coffee cup. And over that mug, it said High Watch Farm. It wasn't Witch Hazel, and it wasn't High Hazel. And sorry, Beverly. Anyway, I got in there, and I guess I did. And they put me in a room, and all of a sudden, I realized what this room was like. It was clammy. It was wet. The sheets were soaking. There were things crawling on the walls, on the floors, on the ceilings. And this went on for I don't know how many days. How could you put a guy like me in a place like this? This was May 2nd of 1978. It was my first day without putting anything in this body. And that was the last day so far up to today. Magically, around the fourth day, I was shaved in clean clothes. Somebody had painted the walls, changed the sheets, got rid of the bugs, the whole nine yards. For those of you that are new, wondering where the heck I went, High Watch is not like that. It was this guy. It was the first time that I had taken alcohol out of this body for a long, long time. 22 years I had been drinking. And I went through the DTs, and they took care of me. And someone had the courtesy to clean me up. And I made it down the back sidewalk and went into the kitchen at that time and looked over on the left-hand side. And there's two metal sheets, 1 through 6, 7 through 12. And I saw the word powerless. And I saw alcohol. Okay. I didn't know what else those were. But over on the right-hand side, there was an orange sign. I think it was the color that got my eyes. And I looked at it and it said, life begins with sobriety. I know what that means today. And I started thinking I was in a safe place. And I sat down for my first meal. And in that meal, Beverly, you and Frank had a sick sense of humor, I think, because there were peas on that plate. And I had to pick these peas up on a fork, and I'm going like a 50 caliber machine gun, and these peas are flying. And the person next to me, I don't know if it was a guy or a woman, and I couldn't tell the difference anyway, started feeding me the rest of that meal. Same sick sense of humor is still there. They had Jell-O for dessert. Pick that up on a teaspoon, and that does a header quicker than the peas. And again, I'm being fed by the person next to me. And I've been in service for most of my sobriety, thanks to my first sponsor. And I don't think I've ever found anything that has defined that situation any better or any simpler than it's just one alcoholic helping another get better. I had fun. I had fun my first 2 weeks. I was getting healthy. They had a doctor that had a needle this long of vitamin B12, and he hit the house with it. And I started getting better physically. For those of you that don't know where High Watch Farm is, it's up near Kent Falls. And there's a huge hill that you have to walk down to get to Kent Falls. And we started down, and every time you walk down, you got to walk back up. And in a two-week period, it was wonderful. A 38-year-old guy all of a sudden starting to feel physically good, laugh from down inside where I live with the other people that were there. And it was wonderful. It was a good sense of belonging. We were getting well together. And at the end of 2 weeks, most of my newfound friends were leaving. So, of course, I went and started packing. I figured this is all over. And Frank called me in his office. And he said, Tony, you're not going anywhere. You got 2 weeks to go. And if I were you, your employee assistance person said you have one more shot. Make the most of it. And I did. I grabbed the big book. I couldn't read. I could not retain an entire sentence. On Tuesday nights and Saturday nights, they had AA meetings that people came in from the outside. And we'd stand up at the end of the meeting and not hold hands at that time, and start reciting the Lord's Prayer. And I'd get beyond "Our Father who art in blank, blank, gone." Couldn't remember the Lord's Prayer. So the mental part, it took a little while to change a voice. Adolescence too is coming. So the physical part was back. The spiritual part, I guess I could call it that. I was sitting in, they have a very, very simple chapel with 12 little chairs up in the front of it, representing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was looking out the window, and there was some kind of a bird in the tree, and it was May, and the buds were popping, and I realized that someone other than me put me in an environment for me to get help, and I better take advantage, grab on with both hands. It might be my last time. I left High Watch Farm on Memorial Day of 1978, came back to the palatial bachelor pad. The little Lithuanian lady, boy, I know how you felt last night. The little Lithuanian lady had cleaned out that motel room, filled the refrigerator with food. The front window was open. I didn't want to bolt lock the door, but I got petrified. I was out of a secure place. I was out in the world, and I was told, go to a meeting. And Newington Thursday night was down the hill at the Congregational Church, and in I went. I climbed up those stairs, got in that room, and there's a man with hair about this tall, like about a quarter of an inch off his head. He had a cigar butt sticking in the right-hand side of his mouth. Little thin guy, poured me a half a cup of coffee, handed it to me, pointed over in a corner of the room. He said, go over there, sit down, and shut up. It's the third time today I've heard shut up. You know who this guy's going to wind up being. Anyway, I didn't like him, but somebody up at High Watch, and I haven't heard this very, very much, but they said, when you get out into AA meetings, we want you to find somebody that doesn't look like you, act like you, or talk like you. And when you find that person, ask them to be your sponsor. Okay, Grumpy didn't look like me, didn't act like me, didn't talk, and I'm not going to ask him to be my sponsor. But he sent me over to a little lady that was over in a corner, and this was Grumpy's wife. And she got up and she gave me the biggest hug, and that's the first hug I had had in years. No one wanted to come near this body, and I kind of felt good. Grumpy came up at the end of the meeting and said, I want you to help me with these chairs, and my car is broken. I want you to come pick me up tomorrow night, and you're going to take me to a meeting. I said, oh, God. But I'm not going to say no. And I did, and he took me to Weathersfield, to Old Weathersfield, that Friday night. Of course, now the car can't be fixed till Monday, so we got Saturday and Sunday. Saturday night, he took me to Fairfield Avenue in Hartford. Sunday, he took me to Hartford Hospital. Monday morning, I got up and went to work, figuring, bye-bye, Grumpy. Not. The phone rang. Car won't be ready. Come get me. I started thinking that this guy ever really had a car. I'm getting better now, right? The mental part started. Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, I'm back in the meeting with a three quarters of a cup of coffee this time. And he said his car had been fixed. And I looked at him and I said, something along the lines like, I really want to thank you because you helped me for 7 straight days stay sober, something I couldn't do myself for the last 22 years. He went on to become my first sponsor in this fellowship. His name was Charles R. His wife was Jeannie. And he was a simple guy. Don't drink and go to meetings was his answer to everything. My financial problems, my sexual problems, don't drink and go to meetings. I needed something more. Like, I wanted him to say, yeah, that's okay. No major relationships for a year. He should have said 5 years for this drunk. But that was him. A couple of weeks later, we were at a District 8 meeting at a St. Pius church in Middletown, and they needed a coffee maker. What, a couple of weeks sober? He said, he'll do it. I wasn't any of the letters. I wasn't a GSR or a DCM, and I'm making coffee for service people. And Grumpy got me there. Grumpy helped me do it. That was a year plus I was making coffee. Then he let me make coffee at the Newington Thursday night meeting. After that. Under his strict supervision. We needed an alternate general service representative. I now had a year of sobriety. Went through the cake. And he said, it's time for you to get active. And like I said, you know, I've been in service work for most of my, all of my sobriety. And I just feel very grateful for this man. He left me. He left me in 1983, I think he passed away, Charles passed away. But not before we had the opportunity to develop an unconditional love affair. And it's the first time I had one of those with another man. He was just something for me. And I didn't know it up till just before he died, but he had a 38-year-old son that was an executive for the same corporation that I worked for that passed away. And he gave me this sons of his company pin, and it was like a father-son relationship. And my dad had already died, and it was wonderful. So I'm forever grateful. I had another sponsor in my life, though, by this time, because I didn't quite go for don't drink and go to meetings all the time. I wanted to hear something about steps. I wanted to see and feel and touch someone else's spirituality. Because I wasn't there. I wasn't getting it. And Rich came into my life. And Rich led me down the service path. Rich led me down getting active in the steps, step meetings, Matt Talbot retreats. I forgot to tell you. No major decisions for a year. Marriage number two is coming. I married another gal in the fellowship. Just happened to be at High Watch at the same time I was. I was 38, she was 21. Perfect, right? Anyway, 385 days into sobriety, Grumpy gave her away. He didn't judge. He gave me his opinion, but he was there. We got married, and that relationship didn't last too long. There were some other problems, and I started losing weight. I started shaking. I grabbed onto my sponsor. I grabbed onto this fellowship, and I grabbed onto the fellowship of Al-Anon. I didn't know where to turn. I was trying to be a fixer, an enabler. Al-Anon taught me a very, very important lesson, and I'll be forever grateful. They turned that finger around and taught me how to point the finger at myself. No one told me to go get a divorce. Nobody said to move out. None of that good stuff. And it gave me more faith, first of all, in my 12-step program as well as theirs. And we did go through a divorce. Fortunately, neither one of us drank over it. And it terminated. So I'm on my own again, into service work. And the Connecticut Convention Committee, which was meeting at Banner Lodge at that time, outside in Moodus, needed somebody to do recreations. So Mr. Perfect grabs his little clipboard and all of his pens, and he's going to go do a perfect job. I was born on September 22nd. I'm a Virgo. And all right, off I went. And committee system? Not my way. And they let me play with it a little bit. And time went on, and I finally became the chairperson of that Connecticut convention at Banner Lodge. And I learned that there were 19 or 20 people on that committee. There were 19 or 20 other ways to get a job done. If you back off, get the speakers, shut my mouth, and make sure I'm available, it worked. And it was a wonderful experience, and I know just exactly what you're going through. And it was beautiful. A good friend of mine that was working with me gave me a call, I guess it was Valentine's Day, said, let's go out for dinner. Okay, here's a gal that had seen me drunk in airports, had walked over my body, left me lying there, let me miss flights. She didn't belong to Al-Anon. And it was just a wonderful friendship. She also knew about my disease. We went out for that Valentine's Day dinner and started a relationship. But we had a 12-year friendship going into it, and it was absolutely wonderful. And hope I get this right. We did get married in 1984, correct? somewhere around there. And we got married, and it was great. But she respected my priority about Alcoholics Anonymous was first in my life. And since that day, many of you know her. She did find this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were in a meeting in Florida, and she admitted that, hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Hillary, and I'm an alcoholic. She said that in a meeting. And you know, I didn't want to be too obvious, but I turned around and I looked at her and I said, what the hell are you saying? And, you know, that there were some signs, but I didn't really know about this closet stuff too much because I didn't do mine in a closet. And sure as heck, she had been around service people in AA. She had seen Alcoholics Anonymous in work. She had seen one alcoholic helping another. And she caught on to this fellowship, and it's been a beautiful ride. But unlike my second marriage, where I worked her program, she worked mine, and we had ours, Hillary has her program, I have mine, and we love to go on AA dates and go to meetings and events. It's been wonderful. My two sons, the love and respect that I had damaged and destroyed has come back through patience and tolerance, and thanks to my sponsor. Both my sons are married now on their own, and I don't care where it is, wherever we meet, there's a major hug there, and it's just great to feel that. It's healthy. And after Hillary and I got married, we were at the Cape Cod a couple of years after that, and had gotten a phone call. It's going to be 8 years ago. Yeah, it's going to be 8 years ago in 2 weeks. But my mom had passed away suddenly, and I didn't know what to do. I had never been involved in a family death in sobriety. I had been drunk. I knew what to do then. And I called my sponsor from the Cape, and Hillary was with me. He met me when I got home. He walked me through the steps. I have no siblings, and we arranged everything together. And my mom was happy. And I had, like again, I said, I had that quality sobriety time with her. And 2 weeks later, two weeks before she had passed away, I finally got this one right, my first granddaughter was born. She'll be 8 tomorrow. So 2 weeks in one spot, God put a little young lady in my life, and 2 weeks later he took one away. And I grew some more. And then there were many, many other service responsibilities. I had worked very hard the 12 steps of this program. I had done my first fourth step quite by accident at a Mount Talbot retreat. It was a Friday night. I had a whole bunch of little tiny papers put in where the fifth step is in the big book, because that's where my sponsor told me to put all my defects and everything that I thought bad and everything that was good. Put little notes in there. And of course, I had a rubber band going around this book. And I sat down, and I had a roommate that night, somebody that was just as close to me as Rich. He had little pieces of paper. But we started the paper thing. I'd read one, he'd read one. He didn't know it, but we were doing our first fifth step together. The sun came up the next morning, and we're still going. We're laughing. We're crying. We both left that Mount Talbot retreat that Sunday afternoon. I think went through every stop sign, every red light, because we're this far off the ground. And that wasn't the last one I had done. Sponsorship. I don't care what service position I've had. I've always made sure I've had some men in my life, sponsees. They have saved my butt more than once. Sometimes you get into a position in service and you might think you're taken off in a bad direction. And to have these guys just pull you up tight and members of your home group pull you up a little tighter to right-size you. I needed it. And they were there. A lot happened in sobriety. A lot of joy. A lot of sorrow. Promotions at work. I took them under sponsorship. Ego didn't kick in too much till not too long ago. A lot of you do know that I became delegate of Area 11, and I was fortunate enough to get that opportunity to serve at the General Service Conference level. That was just an absolute miracle in my life to be able to share in that. And it's something that I'm looking at past delegate faces and right now, and you just don't forget it. And it's so few get the opportunity. And Eva, last night's beautiful speaker, and I served at the same conference, and that's where we first met. And got through that 2 years. And that was like around, I finished 1996. And you automatically become an immediate past delegate. And I had three sponsees waiting for me, and God, with his true sense of humor, put three more in my life after that commitment was filled, and they were all named Bill. They were all named Bill. None of them W, thank God. But what did I have to do? Well, I kind of like, I'm a sponsor, that if we're going to have a relationship, we got to go through the steps together. I've got to get to know you. And what did that do? That brought me back to basics, right, where I needed to go. I got promoted. I got promoted at work. To an executive, along with that came money, business cards, the whole nine yards. And the money felt good. Here it comes. Kids are grown up. All right, we're going places now. I really think I got consumed with that. And my sponsor was not in my life at this time when I got promoted. I didn't know where I was going. But I looked good on the outside. And I tell you, I was fine. I was getting tense. I was getting stressed. And all of a sudden, the time came for areas to ask people in their areas if they had any interest in standing for the next Northeast Regional Trustee nominee from the state. And I believe that if you've got the qualifications, you should prepare yourself to stand. Whether you get it, that's someone else's choice. And I went through the motions. I checked with my wife. I checked with my employer. I read the service manual inside out. And I started getting closer, if that was possible, to the current Northeast Regional Trustee at that time, Mary Jane. And I did all the work. But way down deep inside me, I wasn't going to stand. That means I couldn't do so much of this work stuff, and I'd have to dedicate myself back. So the assembly came. Connecticut's assembly met in that November, and I was still immediate past delegate, and I was sitting up at that table, and something came over me, and I'm telling you the truth. I didn't know if I was going to get sick to my stomach. My feet are fidgeting. And for those of you that knew the delegate at that time, God love her, Lisa T., she's about this tall. And she's sitting next to me, and another past delegate was making himself available, Dick Kay. And he was standing at the mic getting his qualifications, and she gave me such a kick in my shins, I thought I was going to cry. And I looked out at my wife, and I'm getting like a vibe, and Lisa's saying, get up there, you owe it to Area 11. And I did, and you know what happened? I did not win on the first ballot. That was a kick. Delegate was a piece of cake. And, you know, I'm making fun of that, but it was like, I wasn't ready. I usually have my stuff together and how I'm going to read this and tell you, you know, my qualifications, and I'm bumbling and everything else. Well, it went a few ballots, and God love them. Michael had a big election to do that day for everybody else in the area, and he didn't have time for this stuff, so he went to the hat. And my name came out. So I became Connecticut's nominee along with all the other areas in the Northeast region. And you're presented at the next conference by your delegate. Jamie had the opportunity. And it goes through the third legacy procedure. And it went through first ballot, second ballot, and There was a beloved friend in South Jersey, John Kay, and my name were in after five ballots, and the name had to be pulled out of the hat, and it was me. And I became your Northeast Regional Trustee. That was God. The job, the business cards, the money. I retired from that job April 28th of this year, and I can't be any happier. Not to work. You know, my wife's got a resentment because she gets up and goes to work in the morning, and I'm snoring. But it's given me the opportunity to give back a little bit more, and I can spend more time on doing trustee things and being closer to the office, which is your office, our office in New York. And there's a lot of day trips just scooting down there trying to do what I can do. But, you know, I'm getting ready to close. It's almost time to get that music pumping and get the raffles going and everything. But I tell you this service stuff that I've done, not to brag. It's part of my sobriety. It has saved me. It has saved me from those hours of boredom. You know, there's times when I pray for boredom. I just am grateful for that. And sponsorship. And a happy household, a simple household. Granddaughters, three of them. I'm going to close with a trip that I had right after I retired. I took a 7-year-old granddaughter to New York City. She had never been on a train. She had never been in New York. I called GSO and I said, where can I take my date for lunch? And I got like 70-some-odd suggestions of where to take a 7-year-old. And I did. I took her to lunch. We went to F.E.O. Schwartz. I don't know who was the bigger kid that day. Forgot that I'm with a girl, and I had to. You know, she's got to go to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute. I had boys. What do you do with a little girl? Hotels come in handy. You can trust hotels. But we had a great time, and I put her on the subway. We got off at 42nd Street, came up into Times Square, and just to see her eyes makes sobriety worth it. It really did. So there's the, you know, that little girl in my life that God put there when my mom left. It's a great relationship. None of these kids have seen me drunk, and with the grace of God, they won't. Every walk that I've walked, every place I've gone, Mary Jane knows this, that we go a lot of places in the Northeast region, and we do a lot of stuff. I still haven't seen anything that defines one alcoholic helping another any better than the Peas and Jello story. And I'm forever grateful to everybody that's been in my life, and grateful to Connecticut. Thanks for having me.